Good morning. My name is Elizabeth Baker Keffer, and I'm publisher of The Atlantic Monthly, and very happy to be here greeting you all this morning and happy to introduce this panel. I was here at last year's inaugural festival, and I can tell you that if you do everything and see everything as you should, you will be intellectually stretched and physically exhausted by the end of the week. But go for it and have fun. I have a few announcements before we turn to the panel, several announcements. First of all, please do remember to review the agenda, which has changes from the original program, and a daily log that will be passed out every day for program changes. One very important note is that for the 10:15 tutorials, two of the sessions have switched. So Kitsch and the Crisis of the West will now be in Lauder, and Psychology and Politics of Terrorizing and Terrorism will now be in the Marble Garden tent, which is in front of the Meadows reception area. We have added a number of sessions today that you will find in your program, but please take note of sessions with Madeleine Albright and Reverend Peter Gomes, Michael York discussing Shakespeare from an actor's point of view. Both of those are at 2:15, and they were added since the original schedule came out. We have also added an evening exchange at the Jerome Ballroom tonight, Liberalism in America. You need to sign up for that in the Pepke Auditorium. And the 4th of July concert this evening, the Aspen Festival Orchestra, will be free and no tickets required. That's at 7 p.m. tonight. And as I think you probably heard yesterday, the fireworks have been canceled. There are breakfast sessions every day. Sign up for those at Pepke. For lunch today, there are three locations, the Greenwald Tent, the Koch Building Patio, and the Pepke Tent. This afternoon, following the 2:15 tutorial sessions, there will be presenters doing book signings and casual Q&As in the bookstore and in the Pepke tents. And all of the off-campus events require ticketing. So again, for evening exchanges and other off-campus events, sign up for those in Pepke. The Lexus sessions have been oversold, but please, if you've expressed interest, check and confirm at the Pepke tent for those as well. And weather pattern is expected to continue. We're hoping it stays like this, but consider carrying your umbrellas along as well. Now, to our topic at hand, evangelicals in America. Even in our very abbreviated session yesterday afternoon, I saw religion running as a thread through all of the conversations. Shashi Tharoor, with his theme of pluralism, an example of which was his experience at the intersection of multiple faiths in his country of India. Lawrence Krauss, asking if God had any choice in the creation of the universe and questioning whether science will become faith. Richard Land, seconded by Jacqueline Novogratz, raising the question of equality and how we take that American standard and belief system around the world. Anna Deavere Smith, whose pot with holes was a visual metaphor for traditional medicine and spiritual healing. Richard Dearlove, on a more serious note, with his comments on radical Islam and the instincts of its religion to strike out rather than risk marginalization. Finally, and taking us closer to this topic, last night's evening exchange with Laura Ingraham, chastising the mainstream news weeklies for their discovery of the evangelical movement after it had been a force for more than two decades. So looking today then, and looking into the future, what is happening with the evangelical movement in the U.S.? We have four panelists who are at the center of it, and they'll focus this morning on the growth and shape of evangelical Christianity in America and how it is influencing politics, culture, and the world of ideas. So I'll introduce them down the line here, starting with the Reverend Peter Gomes, Plummer Professor of Christian Morals and Pusey Minister, Memorial Church, Harvard University. He's been in that post since 1974. He's an ordained Baptist minister and one of America's most distinguished preachers on the faculty of the Divinity School and the College of Arts and Sciences at Harvard. To his right, Jim Wallace, editor-in-chief of Sojourners Magazine. Jim is described as a Christian leader for social change. He's dedicated his work and his activism and international commentary to ethics and public life. He's the founder of Sojourners, which is Christians for Justice and Peace, and of the magazine that bears the same name, and has been instrumental in forming Call to Renewal, a broad-based federation of faith-based organizations working to overcome poverty. Jim's a book author and a speaker, and his columns appear in several papers and journals, and he's a graduate of Trinity Evangelical Divinity School. Next, Richard Land, President, Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, Southern Baptist Convention, and a commissioner of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. Dr. Land is one of Time's 25 most influential evangelicals and one of National Journal's top 10 church-state experts, the person who politicians call on when they get serious about addressing an important public policy issue. He's host of a nationally syndicated radio program for Faith and Family, And beyond being a radio host, he's an author and a magazine editor, with his writings and commentary reaching millions of Americans. He was educated at Princeton and at Oxford. And finally, Ted Haggard, president of the National Association of Evangelicals, which is a 30 million member evangelical group, the largest in America. Ted Haggard is also founder and senior pastor of the 14,000 member New Life Church in Colorado Springs, and is also one of Time's 25 most influential evangelicals. Time quoted, "No pastor in America holds more sway over the political direction of evangelicism than does Pastor Ted." He's a graduate of Oral Roberts University. Our moderator today is, to my right, Nancy Gibbs, editor-at-large and writer for Time magazine. She's the author of nearly 100 cover stories, including four Person of the Year stories, and she wrote Time's September 11th memorial issue and subsequent coverage, winning the Luce Awards 2002 Story of the Year, and is Yale and Oxford educated, joined Time in 1985. So I'll turn things over to you, Nancy. Thank you.
Good morning. Happy 4th of July. I think we ought to think about this morning as the first of an ongoing conversation over the next couple of days having to do with religion in America and the religious experience. This afternoon, Reverend Gomes and Madeleine Albright are going to discuss religion and foreign policy. Tomorrow afternoon, my colleagues and several others of us here are going to talk about religion and politics. And so I would urge you, as we talk and as questions come to mind and issues you'd like to address, if we don't get to them today, feel free to grab me on campus and let me know what you'd like for us to perhaps come back to tomorrow, because these topics are so interesting and often confounding. I want us to be able to have as free an exchange over the course of these days as we can. As for this morning, where our topic is of course, nice and narrow, evangelicals in America, I don't rule out the possibility of fireworks since it's the 4th of July, but I wanted to start in the broadest sense about, I think that this may be about the sixth time that someone has declared the Third Great Awakening, that we are in some sort of special moment of religious revival right now in this country. And they cite as statistics things like 92% of households owning Bibles and 60% of people saying that their religion is very important to them, that they believe the Bible is infallible. And yet, at the same time, only half can name a single gospel. I'll leave aside the 12% who think that Joan of Arc was Noah's wife. And so what I wonder, to start as a sort of social scientific challenge, is how do we even measure how spiritual we are, how the genuineness of a revival, whether we're in a moment of revival or not, because there may be few things that are harder to measure than the intensity and authenticity of people's individual spiritual experience. So, Dr. Gomes, do you want to start about, are we in the Third Great Awakening or not?
I'm always suspicious of facile historical analogies to great awakenings. They are easy to make. They're very hard to verify or to justify. I think we are in a season of intense religious interest and curiosity. Revival suggests the restoration of something that was once lost. What is clear to me is that the interest in religion and the vitality of religious activity is really not in some attempt to restore something that once was. It's something quite different. It's something quite new. And it's very different from what our fathers and mothers and our grandparents and our ancestors were aware of. And that, I think, is exciting. I say to Harvard graduates, when I go around to speak to them, that there's probably more active religion at Harvard now than there was 150 years ago. And people smile and are surprised because they don't expect any religion at Harvard at all, let alone an increase in it. And I said, but it's not the same kind of religion. It's not the old-time religion to which you and I might appeal in some way. It's a very different kind of religion. So in that sense, there is a heightened religious interest. But the term revival, and especially the term Great Awakening, is, I think, sort of hijacking previous clarities that are no longer present among us. So I would urge us to be cautious about these declarations. And I am cautious, and I'm mildly suspicious of easy labeling of that sort. Now, that may be because of the place in which I ply my craft, in a university where terms are taken seriously, and some would say religion is not, but I would contend that it is. But I think we have a great interest, a great hunger, a great thirst for religious questions and religious answers, and that that is manifesting itself in ways very different than any previous experience. So we have yet to see what this means and how it shapes up, but it's a very exciting time in which to be. And I'm always congratulating Time Magazine on discovering something that has long been around.
Yes, we're proud of that. In fact, one of the points Laura Ingram made last night was one of the reasons for the alienation that some people experience from the mainstream media is the tendency to take an attitude of sort of anthropological bemusement towards things like NASCAR. And so, Pastor Ted, you probably have been the subject of more media scrutiny of when a reporter wants to see what a mega church is like. I think New Life is probably where they head. And so I'd be curious about what do we always get wrong, and do you most have to explain, or what do you think is most misunderstood about the kind of congregation that you lead and the way that you lead it?
Yeah. Well, a couple of things. One is there is a rediscovery of evangelicalism every time there's a conservative evangelical president, and we've seen this cycle happen several times, but evangelicalism has been strong in America since the beginning. The rise of Methodism happened because of evangelicalism in the Methodist Church. The Wesleys were evangelicals. The Methodist Church was an evangelical church for many, many years. And today, the growing churches within Methodism are the evangelical churches. And so when you the difficulty with dealing with evangelicalism is the definition. And we finally came up with a definition that was simple enough to be published in newspapers. And that was, an evangelical is a person who believes the Bible is the Word of God, that Jesus is the Son of God, and that you must be born again. One sentence, two commas, three phrases. And so with that in mind, you see evangelicalism rising right now within the Anglican Church. It's growing more quickly within the population of the Anglican Church than amongst the leaders of the Anglican Church. And where there are intense groups of people with personal faith and growth, there is within the church, so the evangelicals, the people that are born again and believe in the integrity of the Scripture and things like that, then there's people being converted, and there's a flow of life and joy. There's an increase in giving. There's an increase in compassion. There's an increase in concern for the local soup kitchen and eye clinic and a missions trip to Darfur and AIDS problems, and those types of things are on the rise. Now, I think what most often miss when they look at a church like ours is the pluralism in America. Our church is an interdenominational church, which means there are Baptists and Methodists and Mennonites and Catholics and Episcopalians and Lutherans and atheists and agnostics and Satanists and people from all types of backgrounds that have come there and experienced the refreshing of faith and are growing. And most megachurches are like that. There's a new evangelical megachurch in America every 3 days. Megachurch being defined as a church with average attendance of 2,000 people or more. There's also a resurgence of evangelical house churches in America. And those are virtually all evangelical. And so the growth of evangelicalism is amazing. It is hard to measure it. Richard here is representative of the largest evangelical denomination in America, the largest denomination in America.
No, Roman Catholics are large.
Oh, sure. The Roman Catholics would be the largest, but of the Protestant groups, the largest denomination in America. And so very often when people discuss revival or discuss a third great awakening, they miss the pluralistic idea of evangelicalism's broad nature. I'll give you an example of it. Barna Research, when they're researching evangelicalism, they refuse to count into evangelical opinions Roman Catholic evangelicals and African American evangelicals. But 78% of African Americans consider themselves evangelical. Or they may not use that term, but they consider themselves born again. Now, in reference to the revival, new revivals versus old revivals, I think the difference is media. In the old days, they would go to an evangelical service or a Pentecostal service or a you need to be born again service, and then they would go home and talk about it, and that was the best entertainment in town. The local tent meeting or a Brush Arbor meeting or a Methodist meeting or a Baptist meeting. And by the way, the open door for the growth of the Baptist church, which is an evangelical church, and the decline of the Methodist church happened as Methodism backed away from evangelical principles, and the Baptists just kept talking about evangelicalism and the growth of it. But nowadays, when people come to our service, we're more pluralistic. They have a spiritual encounter in church, but they turn on the radio on the way home. The TV or the CD player is at home. So there are more influences. So the impact in life would have to be measured a little differently. But the religious experience is very often very similar. And so since we're in a new generation, I don't think we'll ever have a great awakening like the ones we had pre-radio and television. But I do think we'll have more and even sometimes a higher percentage of conversion in our day. South Korea is a good example. 40 years ago, South Korea was 2% Christian. Today, South Korea is 49% Christian, and the vast majority of that is evangelicalism.
Now, Reverend Wallace, your hero, Charles Goddison Finney, invented the altar call to help recruit abolitionists. And part of the purpose of revival was to bring people of faith into reform movements. Can you talk a little bit now about the divisions you see amongst evangelicals about where their reformist energies might best be applied?
Well, let's talk about that word revival. The church historians remind us something isn't called revival until it changes the society in some way. Just personal faith and renewal is not revival. So I like Finney. He was the great evangelist of his day, Billy Graham, and he did invent the altar call. And he did it because he was having so many converts, he wanted to sign them up for the anti-slavery campaign. I'm basically a 19th century evangelical, born in the wrong century. and I love that time because evangelical Christians led the battles on slavery, women's suffrage, child labor law reform, and I think that's coming back. I go to Christian college campuses all over the country every week, thousands of young people. And the agenda is now poverty and the environment and Darfur and sex trafficking, HIV/AIDS. It's way beyond the sort of 2004 election perception of a narrow two-issue agenda. And so I think we may have, a renewal again, a coming back of that old revival. But I find around the world, particularly in the global South, that the new altar call really is around poverty. The word evangelical comes from evangel, which means good news. And Jesus used that term in his opening mission statement. It was, I call it his Nazareth Manifesto. He said, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to bring the evangel good news to the poor." And what I see happening around the world now, particularly among the new generation, is any gospel that isn't good news to poor people doesn't feel like the gospel. And so there's almost a new altar call rising up, and I think that could. I think, Ted, that could become a new awakening in our time of applying faith directly to this issue of half of God's children living on less than $2 a day, 3 billion people. That, to me, could signal again this new, because it would change society in some way and not just the personal lives of those who have been converted.
How far does that go towards explaining the divide we see between the rest of the developed world, where secular culture seems to become more and more entrenched, and America, and then the developing world, where you have what appears to be a constantly more energetic spirituality? Is that, how much of it do you think is connected to?
Well, I think there are two great hungers in our world today, two great hungers. One is the hunger for spirituality, and the other is the hunger for social justice. And the connection between the two is the one the world is waiting for. So I think that hunger is there, but in the developing world, the energy for social justice now is coming from evangelical Pentecostal churches and young people on the ground. So I'm excited about that.
Dr. Land, you told me last summer that the only people who say that evangelicals are not discriminated against are not evangelicals, and that evangelicals were the only group that it was politically acceptable to mock. Can you help us understand the sense of embattlement that a group that many people perceive as being more influential and more empowered than ever, from your point of view, why that is not the way evangelicals perceive themselves?
Well, because I think evangelicals are certainly a rising force in American society, and they are not confined just within the historic evangelical denominations. There, as Ted has said, there are increasing numbers of people who certainly have an evangelical worldview in the mainline churches and even in Roman Catholicism. But I think that I'll use an example. I was at a conference somewhat like this in Canada 2 years ago, and a Canadian sociologist was trying to describe these weird and wonderful Americans to the Canadians. And he said, I've got statistics here which show that church attendance is very high across the southern and southwestern United States, and that SUVs are very popular, and that gun ownership is at 60% levels. And he said, so the picture you have is of an evangelical, and 43% of Americans, according to his study, believe that the husband, in a marriage, the husband should be the head of the home, which was news to me. That was one of the more encouraging things he said than the whole thing. And then he said, so the picture you have is of a husband who gets up on Sunday morning and holds a 357 on his Magnum on his family, puts them in the SUV, and makes them go to church. And they just thought that was knee-slappingly funny. And I pointed out to them that if similar types of stereotypes had been used against Muslims or Jews or homosexuals, they would have ridden the guy out of the room on a rail. But when it was said about evangelicals, it was perfectly acceptable. You know, we can go back to the infamous Washington Post story about evangelicals being poor, uneducated, and easily led. I can assure you that they're not easily led. It's like trying to herd tomcats. One of the chief beliefs in evangelicalism is the priesthood of the believer, and they take that very seriously. And they're not poor and uneducated. In fact, most recent surveys show that they are above the median income level in both education and in terms of income. But yet I still, when I'm interviewed by press, they say, well, you know, but you're different. You're not a real typical evangelical. Well, I actually am. I'm pretty typical evangelical in many ways, of my generation. I think that it is, there are still a lot of stereotypes. For instance, you know, people like Time discovering evangelicals after the 2004 elections. And evangelicals, I mean, Southern Baptists, according to the Glen Mary people, Southern Baptists are the majority, more Southern Baptists than any other religious group in 38.9% of the counties of the United States. That's a lot of non-Southern counties, by the way. We're growing at 12% a year outside the South and 2% a year inside the South. People are shocked when I tell them that Southern Baptists are 20% ethnic now. We've gone from being a denomination that as late as 1970 was virtually all white to being a denomination that is now 20% ethnic. We have 750,000 African-American Southern Baptists. I preached in a church last Sunday, First Baptist Church of Central Florida, that is about 55% Anglo, 45% ethnic. They've got a Christian school. The majority of the students in the Christian school are people of color. The majority of the students in the school are people of color. And at lunch, I was asked to visit with some of the ethnic denominations, the ones that aren't, that haven't mastered enough English yet to be able to participate in the English-speaking services. And they've got a Vietnamese ministry, they've got a Haitian ministry, they've got a Hispanic ministry, and they've got over 600 people in those ministries, as well as about 2,500 in the main services. That's a far more typical Southern Baptist church than most people outside of evangelicalism would be aware. And so you just have this perpetuation of these stereotypes that I think don't serve good purposes, and it's up to us to dispel them, to challenge people when they engage in them, and to say, well, you know, actually it's a little more complex than that. And I, as a historian and a theologian, I would challenge the fact that Finney invented the altar call. John Leland and Daniel Marshall, who were Connecticut Yankees, who came to North Carolina as part of the First Great Awakening and started the separate, helped start the separate Baptist movement. They were giving altar calls in Sandy Creek Association in North Carolina in the 1750s. So Finney may have popularized it, but Marshall John Leland and Schubel Stearns were doing it in the 1750s.
Well, we could have our history conversation over coffee, but the point is that Finney used the altar call to sign people up for God's purposes in the world. Mm-hmm. That was the powerful thing about what Finney was doing. And one of the stereotypes or the mythologies, Nancy, is that all evangelicals are members of the religious right. And the data shows about 22% of the electorate's white evangelical. Half of them probably are core members of the religious right, but about half are not. And the truth is that the future of American politics is going to be shaped by what moderate evangelicals and Catholics do. And those voters and votes are up for grabs. And Ted will tell you it's an error to say evangelicals are all members of the religious right.
Yeah, let me write on that just a little bit to build on what Richard and we're talking about here. Most people don't know that the Salvation Army is a very influential, very strong evangelical denomination of churches. The Salvation Army is a denomination of churches. And at each congregation then does something to help the community. So that's the way they serve, and that's the way they minister to people, and it's a wonderful denomination. Also to see the diversity within evangelicalism, think in your mind about the last four self-proclaimed evangelical presidents. I let people self-identify. Okay, Ronald Reagan, Jimmy Carter, Bill Clinton, and George Bush. Okay, now you can think of the breadth of political strategy, economic policy, and different things, but those four, all men believed Jesus was the Son of God, the Bible is the Word of God, and you must be born again. And so, and to look at the difference in race and the way of Anglo-evangelicals in the United States, about 80% registered Republican, about 80% vote Republican, about 20% Democrat. In the last election, about two-thirds of the Hispanic evangelicals voted Democrat, about a third voted Republican. Of African Americans, it was the opposite of the whites. 80% voted Democrat, about 20% of evangelicals voted Republican in the last election. So that shows the diversity. And so when a reporter from the outside comes in and tries to do a stereotype of a homeschooled little Southern kid with a gap in their teeth and hoping for the second coming of Jesus so we can all escape the tyranny of America, and that kind of, when they try to do that, they miss it completely. Instead, go look at Rick Warren's church. It's a great evangelical church. Or go look at First Assembly of God of Phoenix, Arizona. It's a great evangelical church, and you'll see buses going out through the neighborhoods. You'll see soup kitchens. You'll see a huge... Our church alone gave $7 million last year to foreign relief and development amongst poor regions.
If I could just follow up on that, Brent, this is our magazine that we sent out to Southern Baptists. You notice the covers on Darfur. When Secretary of State Rice spoke to the Southern Baptist Convention last month, she received 12 standing ovations during the course of her talk, and she said that, we have started a new abolitionist movement to abolish slavery in the world, that slavery is still going on, and that we're going to fight to stop sex trafficking and forced slavery in the world, and we're not going to rest till it ends. She got a 1 minute standing ovation from the assembled messengers of the Southern Baptist Convention. And it's important when people ask me, well, are you part of the religious right? No, I'm the head of the Ethics and Public Policy Agency of the largest Protestant denomination in the United States. When the religious right agrees with us on moral issues, I applaud their good taste. But we spend as much time working on racial reconciliation as we do on the pro-life issue. We spend as much time encouraging Southern Baptists and others to be involved in poverty relief and hunger relief at home and abroad. And Rick Warren's a Southern Baptist and has been one of the prime movers in the in AIDS initiatives in Africa and other places. So I think that it's evangelicalism in general is a far more full-orbed thing than many people that are outside of evangelicalism would think. And it's important to note that even when you have 80% of white evangelicals voting Republican, they're not Republicans. They're voting Republican. Many of them, especially in Southern Baptist life, grew up with parents who, if they didn't identify as Democrats, voted Democrat. They're voting Republican on the life issue, and if the life issue ever becomes a more competitive one in terms of the two parties, you'll see those percentages drop rather precipitously.
I should interrupt here because I'm the only one of the four of us who is not one of 25 influential evangelicals, according to Time magazine. And therefore, I have a point of view.
You get a category all your own.
I'm a category all my own. I was brought up in a mildly lukewarm American Baptist church with a sort of evangelical tinge. I know all the second verses of all the hymns. And I continue to claim the piety of what I am pleased to call our tradition. I will not be put out of it by my liberal friends who have tried to do that, even though my conservative friends are rather suspicious. But I remain where I am. But one of the things, as an observer of American history, that has always intrigued me is that evangelicals, to use this very broad category without any of the niceties that it really requires, evangelicals have always had a hunger for respect. We don't get no respect. We've got all these numbers. We do all these things. We are more interesting and diversified than any of the stereotypes would suggest, and yet we hunger for a kind of approbation that says what you are doing and who you are is not the exception. It is the rule, and you have a legitimate place in the center of our discourse. Evangelicals run the show, by and large. I think they run the cultural show. It's almost, I'd be willing to concede that. And yet, often delight to behave like a persecuted minority. And it seems to me it can't be both ways. You've named four presidents and of varying competencies and interest. I think we'd all say we don't need to specify, but the one thing they all have in common, according to this analysis, is that they're all professed evangelicals. With four presidents in the last 40 years, there should be a sense of, we have arrived, here we are, we are setting the agenda, or we are recalling the agenda. But there's an edgy paranoia about evangelicalism, which doesn't sit well with the position that it holds. And I don't know why that is. Is it because Time doesn't recognize what's going on? Is it because the secular elites who define, even though they may be less than one half of 1% of the country, who define the culture, define evangelicalism either outside of the mainstream or on a dangerous fringe? And that's not a rhetorical question, because I really don't know the answer. I'm intrigued by it.
Well, my answer would be, to the answer that Peter Berger gave when Gallup did a worldwide study of societies around the world and asked a whole battery of questions to try to determine the degree of spirituality in societies around the world. And they discovered that India is the most religious country in the world and that Sweden was the least religious country in the world. And when Peter Berger was told these results, he said, America is a nation of Indians ruled by an elite of Swedes. There's a great deal of, when he said it in 1985, there was even more truth in it than there is today. But there's still a great deal of truth in it. If you look at the faculty list of the Ivy League universities, when I was at Princeton, there was one professor that I knew who would have been classified as an evangelical. He was an evangelical Methodist, Paul Ramsey, a wonderful, wonderful teacher, and a man who had a tremendous influence on me. The evangelicals were just, they were very thin on the ground. And I think in the media, most people in the national media don't really understand evangelicals. They're shocked and surprised when they find that they are as thick on the ground as they are in lots of places. And I do think that there is a real tension between the secular elites. Stephen Carter wrote a wonderful book about this called The Culture of Disbelief, in which he showed that there has been a sustained attempt by the cultural elites in this country, and I hope it's not a shock to you that we do have elites, to seek to marginalize religious faith, to put it on the level with a hobby. In fact, he wanted to call his book God is a Hobby, and the publishers wouldn't let him. And one of the things you discover when you write books is that you don't get to pick your title. They sometimes pick it for you. But I would encourage you to read that book. It was every writer's dream. Bill Clinton came back from Martha's Vineyard and said, he said, I've been reading this book. Everybody ought to read this book. This is a great book. This is a book that shows that what we have in America is freedom for religion, not freedom from religion.
That's pretty good.
Not bad. Bill Clinton's a Southern Baptist.
Stephen Carter's book does explain that.
If he isn't here now, he will be here this week.
Well, if you can hear him, hear him. He's one of the most articulate, reasoned, and he's not a part of, he's an Episcopalian. And he would not consider himself to be certainly a conservative evangelical. But he has talked more sense on this issue and gives the sustained answer to which Peter Berger's anecdote is the short version.
There's another way to put it that I often use where I think I'm often critical of a kind of religious fundamentalist that in my view has taken over too much of politics and tries to politicize religion. But there are secular fundamentalists too. Who do have nothing wrong with being secular. I want to say, and say over and over again, religion does not have a monopoly on morality. It does not. But secular fundamentalists have a disdain for religion, people of faith, and I did this book, the subtitle of which was Why the Right Gets It Wrong and the Left Doesn't Get It. And I've had a lot of pushback from the right, certainly, by saying the only two issues are not just abortion and gay marriage. But I've had a lot of pushback from the left who are saying we don't want any kind of religion or even the moral values conversation it's a nervous one for some of my friends on the left. So there is two battling fundamentalisms in the culture, one religious fundamentalism, one secular fundamentalism. I think most Americans are someplace between those two.
Before I open up to the floor, I have one question about what all of you think it says about the spiritual state of America, the popularity of something like the Da Vinci Code. And do you find that either spiritually or intellectually pernicious in any way, or just harmless fun?
Oh, the Da Vinci Code is fiction, for heaven's sakes. And it's profitable fun for Mr. Brown and harmless fun for everybody else. And all of the exercise about the Da Vinci Code and these programs and these earnest people trying to defend against an attack that doesn't exist in any substantial way, it strikes me as religious paranoia. And all it does is make Mr. Brown richer and happier and sells more books. That's all it does. Any informed Christian who is engaged in any kind of discourse within his or her own tradition is readily prepared to deal with this. Now, the issue is Mr. Brown speaking to a whole host of people who are not engaged in their religious traditions and who are woefully unprepared to deal with this? And if that's the case, then that says that there's a great deal of work that has to be done out there, and somebody's not doing it. But in terms of the substance of the book, for heaven's sakes, people, it is fiction. It is a novel, and a pretty good one.
Well, it is a it's a rivetingly written book. I mean, it's a great read. But I would compare the concern that many of us have about the Da Vinci Code is akin to the concern that people have about Oliver Stone's book on the assassination of his movie on JFK. Mm-hmm. Oliver Stone's a wonderful filmmaker. He's also a wonderful myth maker. Mm-hmm. Most of what he talks about in his movie JFK is utterly wrong, and yet most Americans, all they know about the assassination is what they've seen in Oliver Stone's movie. And Dan Brown said that if he had written the Da Vinci Code not as fiction, he wouldn't have changed anything. So it is sort of Dan Brown's understanding of the Christian faith. And I guess for people who are informed Christians, the Da Vinci Code is laughable. I mean, it's so horrifically erroneous on the idea that the Dead Sea Scrolls contained these secrets. There were no New Testament scrolls found at the Dead Sea. They're all Old Testament manuscripts. And he talks about this close vote at the Council of Nicaea. Well, it was 298-2, which is not close, and it wasn't about whether or not Jesus was divine. It was the way that you defined the divinity. But most Americans don't know that. Most Christians don't know that, unfortunately, because I can't speak for Catholics, but I will speak for evangelical Protestants. Most of us are woefully ignorant of the history of the Christian faith from the end of the book of Revelation until Martin Luther nailed his theses on the wall. One of the things that Paul Ramsey did for me, I was an 18 and a 19 year old freshman and sophomore at Princeton, he introduced me to this incredibly rich wealth of Catholic social thought, starting in medieval with Aquinas and others, that I, as a Baptist, had been totally unexposed to until that time. And I think that's the concern, that it'll perpetuate myths in the same way that Oliver Stone does, because it is an extremely well-written and fascinating book.
But we've always taught through stories. Jesus taught through stories. Dan Brown's teaching through stories. We did it on our side with the Left Behind series. We put it written in novel form. Lots of people came to Christ through it. You know, it wasn't intended to be written as a theological analysis. I mean, I don't know how much correct theology is in there, but
not much.
By my eschatology, not much. But some people would differ with me. But we teach through stories, and Dan's teaching. He's not just writing a novel. That's the celebration of the American idea, though. That Dan puts out the book, and then I just saw just a few days ago the list of the top 25 sellers in the United States of Christian books. And we sell a lot of them. We sell most of our Christian books now through Walmart. And four or five of the top 25 were counter voices to the Da Vinci Code. So not only is Dan making some good money on it, but the counter voices are making some good money on it, and the voices are out there, the debate is raging, people are talking about Christ's divinity and how to articulate it, and it's wonderful. Welcome to America.
Well, I teach in an interesting place, and I teach the history of the interpretation of Christian scripture, and I deal with these kids, many of whom come from strong evangelical traditions and who don't know anything from Acts to the moment they were baptized. That's a big gap. So I spend half my time offending the Roman Catholics, who are horrified at the machinations of the early church, and then the other half, the evangelicals, get very upset when one starts talking about the fundamentalist modernist controversy. But everybody is enlivened and moved in the process. And when somebody comes to me and says, which is true, the Da Vinci Code or the Left Behind series, I say they're both nonsense, but well-written, profitable, instructive nonsense. But it's not the gospel, and don't confuse it.
That's right, they're novels.
Where to begin? Yes, ma'am.
Involvement of women in arriving at that position. And finally, does what you call the pro-life position extend to contraception, sex education, and
everything? Who are you asking?
As many of you as you would allow that.
Dr. Landfoot, the question is about, I assume, broadly speaking, an evangelical position on abortion, how it was arrived at, whether it includes or goes back to various forms of contraception, the role of women in formulation of that policy. Dr. Land, you want to?
Particularly, is it against abortion in service?
Yes, and what permissible exceptions?
Well, I think you would probably get four different answers. Probably in some subtleties from all four of us. I'll give you mine. I believe that abortion is always the taking of a human life. I believe that for biblical reasons. I also believe it for scientific reasons. The baby's heart begins to beat at 24 days after gestation. We have measurable brain waves at 43 days after gestation. 24 days when the heart begins to beat, most women don't know they're pregnant yet for sure. So every time there's an abortion, there's a stopping of a beating heart. That's of grave concern to me. It's of grave concern to me that we've aborted about 47 million American babies since 1973. I personally believe that the only morally defensible reason for aborting an unborn child is if the baby is a direct threat to the mother's physical life. I'm not a pacifist. I believe that it is permissible to use lethal force against human beings to defend other human beings. And so I believe it's permissible to take the baby's life if the motive is to defend the mother's life. I'm willing to compromise on some of the other exceptions politically, because if we did have a law in this country that banned abortion except in the cases of a threat to the mother's life, rape, incest, severe or fatal abnormalities in the fetus, we would eliminate about 98% of the abortions that take place in the United States every year, which have nothing to do with any of those troublesome exceptions. The Southern Baptist Convention is an overwhelmingly pro-life convention, and like most churches in America, the majority of our membership is female. I don't think there's any dissonance between the male and female proportion of the Southern Baptist Convention membership when it comes to this issue. I believe that Jeremiah chapter 1 verse 5. Says that before you were in your mother's womb, I knew you, and while you were in your mother's womb, I sanctified you and made you a prophet to the nations. And you have Psalm 139, verses 13 to 16, where David says that he was knitted and embroidered together in his mother's womb, and all of his parts were written in God's book before any of them came to be. As an evangelical Christian, I believe that God's involved whenever conception takes place, and that God never created a nobody. Everybody is a somebody to God. Now, I take the classic Protestant position on contraception. I don't believe that the primary reason that God created sex was to make babies. But it wasn't good for Adam to be alone, and so he made him a helpmate, a completor, and that the gift of gender, the gift of maleness and femaleness is given to us to be completed in sexual intercourse within marriage. And so I don't see anything morally wrong with using methods of contraception that don't allow conception to take place and then cause spontaneous abortions, as long as it's not used to preclude having children altogether. I believe that is not God's will. God said to be fruitful and multiply. How you define fruitful and multiply depends a great deal on what kind of culture you live in and your ability to sustain the children that you produce.
I want to give Reverend okay. Wallace a chance.
But in terms of sex ed, I think abstinence should be the primary thing that is taught. I don't think we should be giving contraceptives to underage children in public schools. And when people say to me, abstinence doesn't work, well, it works every time it's tried.
I think it's an important question, But I look forward to the day when the first and second questions after a conversation on religion won't be about abortion and gay marriage. I find 2,000 verses in my Bible about poor people. So poverty is, for me, a religious matter, too. On the abortion question, you probably would find four different answers here. But, you know, there's a lot of conversation around this Catholic term, consistent ethic of life. Well, the life issue is important, but the sacredness of life is important, but not just applied to abortion, but a whole range of issues where life is threatened. I sometimes say, if I was an unborn child and I wanted the support of the far right, I should stay unborn as long as possible, because once I'm born, I'm off the map, you know. So I think the life issues are important. I think there's a growing number of people who care about life deeply, and I think pro-life and pro-choice people who use those very kind of inadequate labels could come together around a significant commitment to dramatically reduce the number of unintended pregnancies and the abortion rate in this country and do something about the issue concretely, instead of this symbolic political battle that I think distorts politics across the country.
Nancy, there's a Democratic group in the House of Representatives called Democrats for Life.
Right.
And they've got a very substantive plan that they hope would reduce abortions in this country by 95% in 5 years. And we support all but one of the initiatives. I mean, as a pro-life person and the Southern Baptist Convention as a convention, we support all but one of those initiatives, none of which would make abortion illegal, but would just be providing alternatives and sonograms. The only thing we don't support is handing out condoms in high school.
Wow, look at that. In lieu of the politicizing of religion, do you think that evangelism dating back to the beginning of America has lost sight of its traditional values, not just in like the intellectual head of evangelism, but each member who doesn't necessarily have a chance to be here?
I'm not sure I understand what you mean. Yeah. Say that again.
Are the values that started evangelism the same? And if not, why?
Values that started the evangelical movement, are you referring to people like John Winthrop or Cotton Mather, that sort of person?
That sort of person.
Well, that's a good history question, and hard to really track. I think one of the things to be remembered is that the first generation of English Christians, whom we can identify, at least as far as New England is concerned, with such people as Winthrop and the elder Mather and those people who talked about a city set on a hill, saw themselves as part of a new Reformation, a new Protestant community, and a part of their goal was to create an exemplary community so that the world would look at that community of Christians doing their work and say, it can be done. The thing that got lost in the Reformation and that got lost in England can now be done. That was the ambition of those 17th century New Englanders. And so to one level, the notion of their sense of exceptionalism and their exemplary modeling for the world has not been lost. It's been translated into secular cultural policies of the United States. But there's a direct line between our notion of making the world safe for democracy in 1918 and our importation of our values in the 21st century with those explicitly Christian modeling notions of the 17th century. I think in that sense it is true. But there is a difference in each of the generations that follow, because in the 18th century Great Awakening, when Jonathan Edwards begins his enterprise in Northampton, Massachusetts, he's not preaching social reform. He's talking about a renewed direct relationship between the individual and the God who calls that individual. So Jonathan Edwards could assume a stable Christian society in which people needed to be more directly converted. And then, of course, when the Wesleys come along, the Wesleys argue on the, in the first case that you cannot convert the world unless you yourself be converted. And so it becomes, piety precedes Reformation. And then as we move through the late 19th and early 20th century, Reform, Reformation, in some cases these are fronted by religious values, and in certain other cases the religious values are put aside and they are effectively secularized. I mean, the fact that Woodrow Wilson wants to make the world safe for democracy and is a Presbyterian minister's son does not mean that he is necessarily an evangelical, either by the definition used today or the definition that would have been in place in 1918. Woodrow Wilson was a cold and frosted Presbyterian, whatever that suggests at that point. So my view as an historian to your question is that there are certain of these styles and values that are consistent over the course of our nearly 400 years of activity, but they get transformed by the cultural circumstances in which we find ourselves and by the fact that a Christian society in the United States is no longer necessarily definitive or normative. We are Christians who advance the causes of society, but we have to do so in a world very different from that of 1630 or 1740. So one has to keep those, I think, those distinctions alive.
I don't know. I think we have time for one last question. I don't want to make you all late for your tutorials. Mr. Kondracki, do you want the floor?
Hi. I guess the problem that secular America and moderate Christian America has with evangelicals, especially right-wing evangelicals, is the marrying of the belief system with state power. That is to say that the evangelicals have used state power, for example, to ban and persuasive power to ban abortions in South Dakota, practically one abortion clinic there. They're trying to, they've tried to make homosexuality illegal, keep it illegal. The Texas case was a reversal of that. They're trying to use state power to eliminate the teaching of evolution in the schools, and so on, ban stem cell research. Now, the question is this, does the evangelical movement anticipate a perpetuation of this union with the Republican Party and the use of state power? Is there any problem in the evangelical movement with the bonding of church and state, or Jesus and Caesar?
Now, because this is the subject of our session tomorrow afternoon, and you have wonderfully teed it up for us, Pastor Ted, we haven't heard from you, but
yeah, let me just say it real quickly. Dr. Martin Luther King was a great evangelical, and he didn't mind using state power to correct some wrongs. And we've never mind using state power to defend people who can't defend themselves and to protect people who can't protect themselves. And so most evangelicals believe, on the right wing, they would say, if there's a problem pregnancy, that the fetus is in trouble. On the left, they would say the woman is in trouble. Most evangelicals would say we have two people in trouble. And so we just believe a fetus is a human being and that the woman can speak for herself, but the fetus cannot speak for itself. And so we want to give that person some protections and some opportunities, no different than we fought to give African-Americans protections and no different than Dr. Martin Luther King rallied the churches of the South to give African Americans more protection. So there is always, I don't know of one issue in a democracy that doesn't become political. If you believe people should be able to pray at a meal, that's a political discussion about how that works and how public it should be or how private it should be. If you believe a fetus is a human being, that's an issue. If you believe all human beings are equal, that's a political issue. If you believe all human beings have value, that's a political issue. If you believe in such a thing as an intelligentsia or a family that's specially chosen, like the British would say the royal family is, then that's a political issue. And so where we evangelicals would say, no, that's not the case. And so what mainstream evangelical wants is a voice. And we don't want a theocracy, but we do want a voice. We want a seat at the table. We want to be able to represent these views. And we don't want them discounted just because a secularist says, oh, that's got a religious base.
I'm going to get yelled at if I don't let people go. But those of you who are interested in pursuing this particular topic, because obviously it's a very important one, this is exactly where we will start tomorrow afternoon.
Good. If you're moderating tomorrow, the question you might want to start with, why is...
Can you turn me on? I have an announcement to make. There is a green Jeep in the music parking lot, license plate number 878HV2, which will be towed in less than an hour. A green Jeep, 878HV2. Thank you.